and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. This too, Brahman, is called a footprint of the Tathagata. But a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion, the Blessed One is perfectly enlightened. 23. When his mind is thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of defilement, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to knowledge of the recollection of past lives. He recollects his manifold past lives, that is, one birth, two births, three births, four births, five births, 10 births, 20 births, 30 births, 40 births, 50 births, 100 births, 1,000 births, 100,000 births, many eons of world contraction, many eons of world expansion, many eons of world contraction and expansion. There I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my life term. And passing away from there, I was reborn elsewhere, and there too I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my life term, and passing away from there I was reborn here. Thus, with their aspects and particulars, he recollects his manifold past lives. This too, Brahman, is called a footprint of the Tathagata. But a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion. The Blessed One is perfectly enlightened. 24. When his mind is thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of defilement, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings. With the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, he sees beings passing away and being reborn, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. He understands how beings pass on according to their actions thus. These beings who behaved wrongly by body, speech, and mind, who reviled the noble ones, held wrong view, and undertook actions based on wrong view, with the breakup of the body, after death, have been reborn in a state of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. But these beings who behaved well by body, speech, and mind, who did not revile the noble ones, who held right view, and undertook action based on right view, with the breakup of the body, after death, have been reborn in a good destination, in a heavenly world. Thus, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, he sees beings passing away and being reborn, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and he understands how beings pass on according to their actions. This too, Brahman, is called a footprint of the Tathagata. But a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion. The Blessed One is perfectly enlightened. 25. When his mind is thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of defilement, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to knowledge of the destruction of the taints. He understands as it really is. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. He understands as it really is. These are the taints. This is the origin of the taints. This is the cessation of the taints. This is the way leading to the cessation of the taints. This too, Brahman, is called a footprint of the Tathagata. Something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. But a noble disciple still has not yet come to the conclusion. The Blessed One is perfectly enlightened. The Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good way. Rather, he is in the process of coming to this conclusion. 26. When he knows and sees thus, his mind is liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of existence and from the taint of ignorance. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. He understands. Birth is destroyed. The spiritual life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of being. This too, Brahman, is called a footprint of the Tathagata. Something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. It is at this point that a noble disciple has come to the conclusion, the Blessed One is perfectly enlightened. The Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One. The Sangha is practicing the good way. And it is at this point, Brahman, that the simile of the elephant's footprint has been completed in detail. 27. When this was said, the Brahmin Janusoni said to the Blessed One, Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama. Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark so those with good eyesight can see forms. I now go for refuge to Master Gotama, to the Dhamma, and to the Sangha of monks. Let Master Gotama accept me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge from today until life's end. Majjhima Nikaya 27. Kulahatthi Padopama Sutta 1. 175 through 184. Part 5. The Higher Stages of Training with Similes. 12. Here, monks, a monk resorts to a scheduled resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw. 13. On returning from his alms round, after his meal he sits down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect and establishing mindfulness before him, abandoning longing for the world, as in preceding text, stanza 18. He purifies his mind from doubt. 14. Monks, suppose a man were to take a loan and undertake business, and his business were to succeed so that he could repay all the money of the old loan, and there would remain enough extra to maintain a wife, or, considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Or suppose a man were afflicted, suffering and gravely ill, and his food would not agree with him, and his body had no strength. But later he would recover from the affliction, and his food would agree with him, and his body would regain strength. On considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Or suppose a man were imprisoned, but later he would be released, safe and secure, with no loss to his property. On considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Or suppose a man were a slave, not self-dependent, but dependent on others, unable to go where he wants, but later he would be released from slavery, self-dependent, independent of others, a free man able to go where he wants. On considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Or suppose a man with wealth and property were to enter a road across a desert, but later on he would cross over the desert, safe and secure, with no loss to his property. On considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. So too, monks, while these five hindrances have not yet been abandoned in himself, a monk sees them respectively as a debt, illness, a prison, slavery, and a road across a desert. But when these five hindrances have been abandoned in himself, he sees that as freedom from debt, recovery from illness, release from prison, freedom from slavery, and a land of safety. 15. Having abandoned these five hindrances, defilements of the mind that weaken wisdom, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, he enters and dwells in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thought and examination, with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. He makes the rapture and happiness born of seclusion drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, So there is no part of his whole body that is not pervaded by the rapture and happiness born of seclusion. Just as a skilled bathman or a bathman's apprentice heaps bath powder into a metal basin and, sprinkling it gradually with water, kneads it until the moisture wets his ball of bath powder, soaks it, and pervades it inside and out, yet the ball itself does not ooze. So too, a monk makes the rapture and happiness born of seclusion drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body that is not pervaded by the rapture and happiness born of seclusion. 16. Again, monks, with the subsiding of thought and examination, he enters and dwells in the second jhana, which has internal confidence and unification of mind, is without thought and examination, and has rapture and happiness born of concentration. He makes the rapture and happiness born of concentration drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body that is not pervaded by the rapture and happiness born of concentration. Just as though there were a lake whose waters welled up from below, and it had no inflow from east, west, north, or south, and would not be replenished from time to time by showers of rain, then the cool fount of water welling up in the lake would make the cool water drench, steep, fill, and pervade the lake, so that there would be no part of the whole lake that is not pervaded by cool water. So too, a monk makes the rapture and happiness, born of concentration, drench, steep, fill, and pervade the body, so that there is no part of his whole body that is not pervaded by the rapture and happiness born of concentration. 17. Again, monks, with the fading away as well of rapture, he dwells equanimous and mindful and clearly comprehending. He experiences happiness with the body. He enters and dwells in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare, "He is equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happy." He makes the happiness divested of rapture drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body that is not pervaded by the happiness divested of rapture. Just as in a pond of blue or red or white lotuses, some lotuses that are born and grow in the water thrive immersed in the water without rising out of it, and cool water drenches, steeps, fills and pervades them to their tips and their roots, so that there is no part of all those lotuses that is not pervaded by cool water. So too, a monk makes the happiness divested of rapture drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body that is not pervaded by the happiness divested of rapture. 18. Again, monks, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous disappearance of joy and dejection, a monk enters upon and dwells in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. He sits pervading his body with a pure bright mind, so that there is no part of his whole body that is not pervaded by the pure bright mind. Just as though a man were sitting covered from the head down with a white cloth, so that there would be no part of his whole body that is not pervaded by the white cloth. So too, a monk sits pervading this body with a pure bright mind, so that there is no part of his whole body that is not pervaded by the pure bright mind. 19. When his mind is thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of defilements, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to knowledge of the recollection of past lives. He recollects his manifold past lives, that is, one birth, two births, as in preceding text, stanza 23. Thus, with their aspects and particulars, he recollects his manifold past lives. Just as a man might go from his own village to another village, and then back again to his own village, he might think, "I went from my own village to that village, and there I stood in such a way, sat in such a way, spoke in such a way, kept silent in such a way. And from that village I went to that other village, and there I stood in such a way, sat in such a way, spoke in such a way, kept silent in such a way. And from that village I came back again to my own village. So too a monk recollects his manifold past lives. Thus, with their aspects and particulars, he recollects his manifold past lives. 20. When his mind is thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of defilements, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings, as in preceding text, stanza 24. Thus with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, he sees beings passing away and being reborn, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and he understands how beings pass on according to their actions. Just as though there were two houses with doors, and a man with good sight standing there between them, and saw people entering the houses, and coming out and passing to and fro. So too with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human. A monk sees beings passing away and being reborn, and he understands how beings pass on according to their actions. 21. When his mind is thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of defilements, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, he directs it to knowledge of the destruction of the taints. He understands as it actually is. This is suffering, as in preceding text, stanzas 25 through 26. He understands birth is destroyed. The spiritual life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of being. Just as if there were a lake in a mountain recess, clear, limpid, and undisturbed, so that a man with good sight standing on the bank could see shells, gravel, and pebbles, and also shoals of fish swimming about and resting. He might think, there is this lake, clear, limpid, and undisturbed, and there are these shells, gravel, and pebbles, and also these shoals of fish swimming about and resting. So too a monk understands as it actually is. This is suffering. He understands birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of being. From Majjhima Nikaya 39. Maha Asapura Sutta 1. 274 through 280. Chapter 8. Mastering the Mind. Introduction. Having presented a broad overview of the world transcending path in the previous chapter, in this chapter and the next, I intend to focus more specifically on two aspects of this path as described in the Nikayas: meditation and wisdom. As we have seen, the gradual training is divided into the three sections of moral discipline, concentration, and wisdom. See pages 225 through 226. Moral discipline begins with the observance of precepts, which anchor one's actions in principles of conscientious behavior and moral restraint. The undertaking of precepts, for the Nikayas, particularly the full code of monastic precepts, is called the training in the higher moral discipline, Adhisila Sikha. Moral discipline, consistently observed, infuses the mind with the purifying force of moral virtue, generating joy and deeper confidence in the Dhamma. Established upon moral discipline, the disciple takes up the practice of meditation, intended to stabilize the mind and clear away the obstacles to the unfolding of wisdom. Because meditation elevates the mind beyond its normal level, this phase of practice is called the training in the higher mind, Adhisita Sikha. Because it brings inner stillness and quietude, it is also called the development of serenity, Samatha Bhavana. Successful practice results in deep concentration or mental unification, samadhi, also known as internal serenity of mind, ajhatam seto samatha. The most eminent types of concentration recognized in the Nikayas are the four jhanas, which constitute right concentration, summa samadhi, of the Noble Eightfold Path. Beyond the jhanas lie the four formless attainments, arupa samapatti, which carry the process of mental unification to still subtler levels. The third stage of practice is the training in the higher wisdom, adhipanya-sikha, designed to awaken direct insight into the true nature of things as disclosed by the Buddha's teaching. This will be dealt with in detail in the following chapter. The first selection below, text 8.1, is a miscellany of short epigrams that stress the need for mental cultivation. The sayings occur in pairs. In each pair, the first member signals the dangers of the uncultivated mind. The second extols the benefits of the cultivated mind. The uncultivated mind is easy prey to the defilements, greed, hatred, and delusion, and their offshoots. The defilements generate unwholesome kamma, which bring painful results both in this life and in future lives. Since the defilements are the cause of our suffering and bondage, the path to liberation necessarily involves a meticulous process of mental training intended to subdue them and ultimately uproot them from their nesting place in the deep recesses of the mind. From development of the mind arise happiness, freedom, and peace. Development of the mind for the Nikayas means the development of serenity, samatha, and insight, vipassana. Text 8.2.1 says that when serenity is developed, it leads to concentration and the liberation of the mind from such emotional defilements as lust and ill will. When insight is developed, it leads to the higher wisdom of insight into the true nature of phenomena and permanently liberates the mind from ignorance. Thus, the two things most needed to master the mind are serenity and insight. Since concentration is the basis for wisdom, the Nikayas usually treat the development of serenity as the precursor to the development of insight. However, because the aptitudes of meditators differ, several suttas allow for alternative approaches to this sequence. Text 8.2.2 speaks of four approaches to mental cultivation. 1. The first approach, the classical one, is to develop serenity first and insight afterward. By serenity is meant the jhanas, or, according to the Pali commentaries, a state bordering on the jhanas called access or threshold concentration, upakara samadhi. 2. A second approach is to develop insight first and serenity afterward. Since there can be no real insight without concentration, such meditators, presumably people with sharp intellectual faculties, must initially use concentration as the basis for acquiring insight into the true characteristics of phenomena. However, it seems that such concentration, though sufficient for insight, is not strong enough to allow for a breakthrough to the supramundane path. These meditators must therefore return to the task of unifying the mind before resuming the work of insight. Such insight, based on concentration, culminates in the supramundane path. 3. A third approach is to develop serenity and insight in tandem. Meditators who take this approach first attain a particular level of concentration, such as a jhana or formless attainment, and then employ it as a basis for insight. Having developed insight, they then return to concentration, attain a different jhana or formless attainment, and use that as a basis for insight. Thus, they proceed until they reach the supramundane path. 4. The description of the fourth approach is somewhat obscure. The sutta says that a monk's mind is seized by agitation about the teachings, and then, some time later, he gains concentration and attains the supramundane path. This statement suggests a person initially driven by such intense desire to understand the Dhamma that he or she cannot focus clearly upon any meditation object, Later, with the aid of certain supporting conditions, this person manages to subdue the mind, gain concentration, and attain the supramundane path. Text 8.2.3 again confirms that both serenity and insight are necessary, and also indicates the skills needed for their respective practice. The cultivation of serenity requires skill in steadying, composing, unifying, and concentrating the mind. The cultivation of insight requires skill in observing, investigating, and discerning conditioned phenomena, spoken of as formations, sankhara. In line with the preceding text, this sutta confirms that some meditators begin by developing internal serenity of mind, others by developing the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena, others by developing both in tandem. But while meditators may start off differently, eventually they must all strike a healthy balance between serenity and insight. The exact point of balance between the two will differ from one person to another. But when a meditator achieves the appropriate balance, serenity and insight join forces to issue in the knowledge and vision of the Four Noble Truths. This knowledge and vision, the world transcending wisdom, occurs in four distinct installments, the four stages of realization which, in sequence, permanently destroy ignorance along with the affiliated defilements. Text 8.2.2 subsumes these defilements under the expression, the fetters and underlying tendencies. The main impediments to the development of serenity and insight are collectively called the five hindrances, which we already met in the extended account of the gradual training. See text 7.4, stanza 18. Text 8.3 states that just as different impurities of water prevent us from clearly seeing the reflection of our face in a bowl of water, so the five hindrances prevent us from properly understanding our own good and the good of others. A meditator's initial efforts, therefore, have to be devoted to the task of overcoming the hindrances. Once these are overcome, success is assured in the practice of serenity and insight. Text 8.4 compares the successive stages in the purification of the mind to the refinement of gold. The meditating monk begins by removing the gross impurities of bodily, verbal, and mental conduct. This is achieved by moral discipline and vigilant introspection. Then he eliminates the middle-level impurities of unwholesome thoughts, thoughts of sensuality, ill will, and harmfulness. Next come the subtle impurities of meandering thoughts. Finally, he must eliminate thoughts about the Dhamma, the subtlest obstacle. When all such distracting thoughts are removed, the monk attains mental unification, ikobidhava, the basis for the six direct knowledges, abhinya, culminating in arahantship, the knowledge of the destruction of the taints. The Nikayas sometimes compare the process of training the mind to the taming of a wild animal. Just as an animal trainer has to use various techniques to bring the animal under control, the meditator has to draw upon various methods to subdue the mind. It is not enough to be acquainted with one meditation technique. One must be skilled in a number of methods intended as antidotes to specific mental obstructions. In text 8.5, the Buddha explains five ancillary techniques, here called signs, nimitta, that a monk might deploy to eliminate unwholesome thoughts connected with lust, hatred, and delusion. One who succeeds in overcoming distracting thoughts by the use of these techniques is called a master of the courses of thought. The suttas teach various techniques of meditation aimed at inducing concentration. One popular formula pits specific meditation subjects against the unwholesome mental states they are intended to rectify. Thus the meditation on the unattractive nature of the body, see text 8, stanza 10, is the remedy for sensual lust. Loving kindness is the remedy for ill will. Mindfulness of breathing is the remedy for restlessness. And the perception of impermanence is the remedy for the conceit, I am. The perception of impermanence is a subject of insight meditation, the other three subjects of serenity meditation. Loving kindness is the first of the four divine abodes, Brahma Vihara. or immeasurable states. Apamanya, briefly described in chapter 5. Boundless loving kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, and equanimity. These are respectively the antidotes to ill will, harmfulness, discontent, and partiality. Since we already introduced the standard canonical passage on the divine abodes in connection with meditation as a basis for merit, see text 5.5.2, to shed a different spotlight on this practice, I have included here, as text 8.6, the famous simile of the saw, a passage that shows loving kindness in action. Through the centuries, the most popular meditation subjects among lay Buddhists have probably been the six recollections, anusati, of the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, morality, generosity, and the Devas. Text 8.7 is an important canonical source for these meditations. Their themes are especially close to the hearts and everyday experiences of people living household lives in a culture imbued with Buddhist values. These meditation practices in turn enrich and uplift their lives, bringing them into closer spiritual contact with the ideals of religious faith. The first three are primarily devotional recollections that build upon confidence in the three jewels, but while they begin with faith, they temporarily cleanse the mind of defilements and conduce to sustained concentration. The meditation on moral discipline develops from one's observance of the precepts, a practice aimed at self-benefit. The recollection of generosity builds upon one's practice of giving, an altruistic practice. The recollection of the Devas is a contemplation of the fruits of one's faith, morality, generosity, and wisdom as they mature in future lives. The discourse, generally considered to offer the most comprehensive instructions on meditation practice, is the Satipatthana Sutta. Two versions of this sutta exist, a longer version in the Dikha Nikaya, a middle-length version in the Majjhima Nikaya. The former differs from the latter only by its extended analysis of the Four Noble Truths, which may have originally been an early commentary incorporated into the discourse. The middle-length version is included here as text 8.8, an entire chapter in the Samyutta Nikaya. The Satipatthana Samyutta is also devoted to this system of meditation. The Satipatthana Sutta does not recommend a single meditation subject, nor even a single method of meditation. Its purpose, rather, is to explain how to establish the mode of contemplation needed to arrive at realization of Nibbana, the appropriate frame of mind to be established, as implied by the title of the sutta, is called an establishment of mindfulness. The word satipatthana should probably be understood as a compound of sati, mindfulness, and upatthana, establishment. Hence, establishment of mindfulness would be the rendering that best captures the original meaning. According to the standard formula that accompanies each exercise, a satipatthana is a mode of dwelling, viharati. This mode of dwelling involves observation of objects in the proper frame of mind. The frame of mind consists of three positive qualities, energy, atapa, ardor, mindfulness, sati, and clear comprehension, sampajanya. The word sati originally meant memory, but in the present context, it signifies recollection of the present, a sustained awareness of what is happening to us and within us on each occasion of experience. Mindfulness, in its initial stages, is concerned with keeping the contemplative mind continually on its object, which means keeping the object continually present to the mind. Mindfulness prevents the mind from slipping away, from drifting off under the sway of random thoughts into mental proliferation and forgetfulness. Mindfulness is often said to occur in close conjunction with clear comprehension, a clear knowledge and understanding of what one is experiencing. The opening formula of the sutta says that one engages in this practice after having subdued longing and dejection in regard to the world. Vinaya loke abhijha domanasam. The expression, having subdued, need not be taken to imply that one must first overcome longing and dejection, which, according to the commentary, signify greed and aversion, and thus represent the five hindrances, before one can start to practice satipatthana. The expression might be understood to mean that the practice is itself the means of overcoming longing and dejection. Thus, while subduing the obstructive influences of greed and aversion, the meditator arouses the positive qualities of energy, mindfulness, and clear comprehension, and contemplates four objective domains: the body, feelings, states of mind, and phenomena. It is these four objective domains that differentiate mindful observation into four establishments of mindfulness. The four objective domains divide the expository portion of the Satipatthana Sutta into four major sections. Two of these sections, the first and the fourth, have several subdivisions. When the divisions are added up, we obtain altogether 21 meditation subjects. Several of these can be used as means to develop serenity, samatha. But the Satipatthana system as a whole seems especially designed for the development of insight. The main sections with their divisions are as follows. 1. Contemplation of the body, kayanupassana. This comprises 14 subjects of meditation: mindfulness of breathing, contemplation of the four postures, clear comprehension of activities, attention to the unattractive nature of the body, viewed by way of its organs and tissues, attention to the elements, and 9 charnel ground contemplations. Contemplations based on corpses in different stages of decomposition. 2. Contemplation of feeling, vedananupassana. Feeling is differentiated into 3 primary types: pleasant, painful, and neither painful nor pleasant, which are each further distinguished into carnal and spiritual feelings. However, because these are all merely different types of feeling, the contemplation of feeling is considered one subject. 3. Contemplation of mind, sittanupassana. This is one subject of contemplation, the mind, differentiated into 8 pairs of contrasting states of mind. Contemplation of phenomena, dhammanupassana. The word dhamma here probably signifies phenomena, which are classified into 5 categories governed by the Buddha's teachings. The dhamma, thus dhammanupassana, has a dual meaning: dhammas, phenomena, contemplated by way of the dhamma, the teaching. The 5 categories are the 5 hindrances, the 5 aggregates, the 6 internal and external sense bases, the 7 factors of enlightenment, and the 4 noble truths. Although not specified in the sutta, a progressive sequence seems to be implied by the terms of describing each contemplation. In mindfulness of breathing, one moves to subtler levels of quiescence. In contemplation of feeling, one moves toward non-carnal feelings that are neither painful nor pleasant. In contemplation of mind, one moves towards states of mind that are concentrated and liberated. These all suggest that progressive contemplation brings enhanced concentration. In the contemplation of phenomena, the emphasis shifts toward insight. One begins by observing and overcoming the 5 hindrances. The overcoming of the hindrances marks success in concentration. With the concentrated mind, one contemplates the 5 aggregates and the 6 sense bases. As contemplation gains momentum, the 7 factors of enlightenment become manifest, and the development of the 7 enlightenment factors culminates in knowledge of the 4 noble truths. Knowledge of the 4 noble truths liberates the mind from the defilements, and thus leads to the attainment of nibbana. Thus, this system of meditation fulfills the potential ascribed to it by the Buddha of leading directly to the realization of nibbana. Each major contemplative exercise is supplemented by an auxiliary section, a refrain with 4 subdivisions. The first states that the meditator contemplates the object internally, within his or her own experience, externally, reflectively considering it as occurring within the experience of others, and both. This ensures that one obtains a comprehensive and balanced view of the object. The second portion states that the meditator contemplates the object as subject to origination, as subject to vanishing, and as subject to both origination and vanishing. This brings to light the characteristic of impermanence, and thus leads to insight into the three characteristics, impermanence, suffering, and non-self, anicca, dukkha, anatta. The third states that the meditator is simply aware of the bare object to the extent necessary for constant mindfulness and knowledge. And the fourth describes the meditator as dwelling in a state of complete detachment, not clinging to anything in the world. In the Satipatthana Sutta, mindfulness of breathing, anapanasati, is included as merely one meditation subject among others. But the Nikayas assign it a position of fundamental importance. The Buddha said that he used mindfulness of breathing as his main meditation subject for the attainment of enlightenment. See Samyutta Nikaya 54.8.5.3.17. During his teaching career, he occasionally went into seclusion to devote himself to the concentration gained through mindfulness of breathing. And he confers on it a unique honor by calling it the Tathagata's dwelling. Samyutta Nikaya 54.11.5.3.26. Mindfulness of breathing is the subject of an entire chapter in the Samyutta Nikaya. Samyutta Nikaya 54. Anapana Samyutta. Whereas the Satipatthana Sutta explains mindfulness of breathing by a four-step formula, the suttas in this collection expand its practice to 16 steps. Text 8-9 from the Anapana Samyutta describes the 16 steps. Since these steps are not necessarily sequential but partly overlap, they might be thought of as facets rather than actual steps. The 16 facets are grouped into four tetrads, each of which corresponds to one of the four establishments of mindfulness. The first tetrad contains the four facets mentioned in the Satipatthana Sutta in its section on contemplation of the body. But the other tetrads extend the practice to the contemplations of feelings, mind, and phenomena. Thus, the development of mindfulness of breathing can fulfill not just one, but all four establishments of mindfulness. The four establishments of mindfulness, based on mindfulness of breathing, in turn, fulfill the seven factors of enlightenment, and these in turn fulfill true knowledge and liberation. This exposition thus shows mindfulness of breathing to be a complete subject of meditation that begins with simple attention to the breath and culminates in the permanent liberation of the mind. Finally, in text 8-10, the Buddha's chief disciple, the Venerable Sariputta, testifies to his own achievement of mastery over the mind. In reply to questions from the Venerable Ananda, he explains how he is able to dwell for a whole day in each of the jhanas and formless attainments, as well as in the special attainment called the cessation of perception and feeling. Sannyavidayi Tanirodha. In each case, because he is an arahant, he can do so without grasping these attainments with thoughts of I and mine. Chapter 8. Mastering the Mind. Part 1. The mind is the key. 1. I do not perceive even one other thing, O monks, that is so unwieldy as an undeveloped mind. An undeveloped mind is truly unwieldy. 2. I do not perceive even one other thing, O monks, that is so wieldy as a developed mind. A developed mind is truly wieldy. 3. I do not perceive even one other thing, O monks, that leads to such great harm as an undeveloped mind. An undeveloped mind leads to great harm. 4. I do not perceive even one other thing, O monks, that leads to such great benefit as a developed mind. A developed mind leads to great benefit. 9. I do not perceive even one other thing, O monks, that when undeveloped and uncultivated entails such great suffering as the mind. The mind, when undeveloped and uncultivated, entails great suffering. 10. I do not perceive even one other thing, O monks, that when developed and cultivated entails such great happiness as the mind. The mind, when developed and cultivated, entails great happiness. Anguttara Nikaya 1. 3. 1, 2, 3, 4, 9, 10. 1, 5 through 6. Part 2. Developing a pair of skills. Verse 1. Serenity and insight. Two things, O monks, partake of true knowledge. What two? Serenity and insight. When serenity is developed, what benefit does one experience? The mind is developed. When the mind is developed, what benefit does one experience? All lust is abandoned. When insight is developed, what benefit does one experience? Wisdom is developed. When wisdom is developed, what benefit does one experience? All ignorance is abandoned. A mind defiled by lust is not liberated, and wisdom defiled by ignorance is not developed. Thus, monks, through the fading away of lust there is liberation of the mind, and through the fading away of ignorance there is liberation by wisdom. Anguttara Nikaya 2, 3, 10, 1, 61. Verse 2. Four ways to arahantship. Thus have I heard. On one occasion the Venerable Ananda was dwelling at Kosambi in Gosita's monastery. There the Venerable Ananda addressed the monks thus. Friends. Yes, friend, the monks replied. Thereupon the Venerable Ananda said, Friends, whatever monks or nuns declare before me that they have attained the final knowledge of arahantship, all these do so in one of four ways. What four? Here, friends, a monk develops insight preceded by serenity. While he thus develops insight preceded by serenity, the path arises in him. He now pursues, develops, and cultivates that path. And while he is doing so, the fetters are abandoned and the underlying tendencies eliminated. Or again, friends, a monk develops serenity preceded by insight. While he thus develops serenity preceded by insight, the path arises in him. He now pursues, develops, and cultivates that path. And while he is doing so, the fetters are abandoned and the underlying tendencies eliminated. Or again, friends, a monk develops serenity and insight joined in pairs. While he thus develops serenity and insight joined in pairs, the path arises in him. He now pursues, develops, and cultivates that path. And while he is doing so, the fetters are abandoned and the underlying tendencies eliminated. Or again, friends, a monk's mind is seized by agitation about the teaching. But there comes a time when his mind becomes internally steadied, composed, unified, and concentrated. Then the path arises in him. He now pursues, develops, and cultivates that path. And while he is doing so, the fetters are abandoned and the underlying tendencies eliminated. Friends, whatever monks or nuns declare before me that they have attained the final knowledge of arahantship, all these do so in one of these four ways. Anguttara Nikaya 4.170, 2.156 through 157. Verse 3. Four kinds of persons. These four kinds of persons, O monks, are found existing in the world. What for? Here, monks, a certain person gains internal serenity of mind, but does not gain the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena. Another person gains the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena, but does not gain internal serenity of mind. Another person gains neither internal serenity of mind, nor the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena, and another person gains both internal serenity of mind and the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena. Therein, monks, the person who gains internal serenity of mind, but not the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena, should approach one who gains the higher wisdom and inquire of him, How, friend, should formations be seen? How should formations be explored? How should formations be discerned with insight? The other then answers him, as he has seen and understood the matter thus, Formations should be seen in such a way. They should be explored in such a way. They should be discerned with insight in such a way. At a later time, this one gains both internal serenity of mind and the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena. Therein, monks, the person who gains the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena but not internal serenity of mind should approach one who gains internal serenity and inquire of him, How, friend, should the mind be steadied? How should the mind be composed? How should the mind be unified? How should the mind be concentrated? The other then answers him, as he has seen and understood the matter thus. The mind should be steadied in such a way, composed in such a way, unified in such a way, concentrated in such a way. At a later time, this one gains both internal serenity of mind and the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena. Therein, monks, the person who gains neither internal serenity of mind nor the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena should approach one who gains both and inquire of him, how, friend, should the mind be steadied? How, friend, should formations be seen? The other then answers him as he has seen and understood the matter thus. The mind should be steadied in such a way. Formations should be seen in such a way. At a later time, this one gains both internal serenity of mind and the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena. Therein, monks, the person who gains both internal serenity of mind and the higher wisdom of insight into phenomena should establish himself in just these wholesome states and make a further effort for the destruction of the taints. Anguttara Nikaya 4.94 2.93-95 Part 3. The Hindrances to Mental Development. Then the Brahmin Sangarava approached the Blessed One, exchanged greetings with him, sat down to one side and said, Master Gotama, why is it that sometimes even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited? And why is it that sometimes those texts that have not been recited over a long period recur to the mind, let alone those that have been recited? Brahmin, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by sensual lust, overwhelmed by sensual lust, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen sensual lust, on that occasion one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good, or the good of others, or the good of both. Then even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahmin, there is a bowl of water mixed with red, yellow, blue, or crimson dye. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahmin, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by sensual lust, even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Again, Brahmin, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by ill will, overwhelmed by ill will, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen ill will, on that occasion one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good, or the good of others, or the good of both. Then even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahmin, there is a bowl of water being heated over a fire, bubbling and boiling. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahmin, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by ill will, even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Again, Brahmin, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by dullness and drowsiness, one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen dullness and drowsiness. On that occasion, one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good, or the good of others, or the good of both. Then even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahmin, there is a bowl of water covered over with water plants and algae. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahmin, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by dullness and drowsiness, even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Again, Brahmin, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by restlessness and remorse, overwhelmed by restlessness and remorse, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen restlessness and remorse, on that occasion, one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good, or the good of others, or the good of both. Then, even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water stirred by the wind, rippling, swirling, turned into wavelets. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by restlessness and remorse, even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Again, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by doubt, overwhelmed by doubt, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen doubt, on that occasion one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good, or the good of others, or the good of both. Then even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water that is turbid, unsettled, muddy, placed in the dark. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by doubt, even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. This, Brahman, is the reason why even those texts that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Brahman, when one dwells with a mind that is not obsessed by sensual lust, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and remorse, and doubt, on that occasion, even those texts that have not been recited over a long period recur to the mind, let alone those that have been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water that is not mixed with dyes, not bubbling and boiling, not covered over with water plants and algae, not stirred by the wind and churned into wavelets, clear, serene, limpid, set out in the light. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would know and see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind that is not obsessed by sensual lust, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and remorse, and doubt, on that occasion, even those texts that have not been recited over a long period recur to the mind, let alone those that have been recited. This, Brahman, is the reason why even those texts that have not been recited over a long period recur to the mind, let alone those that have been recited. When this was said, the Brahmin Sangarava said to the Blessed One, "Magnificent Master Gotama, let Master Gotama accept me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge from today until life's end." Samyutta Nikaya 46:55, abridged. 5:121-126. Part 4. The Refinement of the Mind. There are, O monks, gross impurities in gold, such as earth and sand, gravel and grit. Now the goldsmith or his apprentice first pours the gold into a trough and washes, rinses, and cleans it thoroughly. When he has done this, there still remains moderate impurities in the gold, such as fine grit and coarse sand. Then the goldsmith or his apprentice washes, rinses, and cleans it again. When he has done this, there still remain minute impurities in the gold, such as fine sand and black dust. Now the goldsmith or his apprentice repeats the washing, and thereafter only the gold dust remains. He now pours the gold into a melting pot, smelts it, and melts it together, but he does not yet take it out from the vessel, as the dross has not yet been entirely removed and the gold is not yet quite pliant, workable, and bright. It is still brittle and does not yet lend itself easily to molding. But a time comes when the goldsmith or his apprentice repeats the melting thoroughly, so that the flaws are entirely removed. The gold is now quite pliant, workable, and bright, and it lends itself easily to molding. Whatever ornament the goldsmith now wishes to make of it, be it a diadem, earrings, a necklace, or a golden chain. The gold can now be used for that purpose. It is similar, monks, with a monk devoted to the training in the higher mind. There are in him